This is the I Read Comic Books podcast. This week's episode was recorded on December 28th, 2015. On this week's episode, Nick White, Tia Vasilio, and I, Xander Riggs, talk about what we read over the holidays and chat about our comic picks for the week. We then go on to discuss comic book distribution and marketing in what is probably its most broad sense. As you can tell, I am not Mike Rappin, the show's usual host. We had a little snafu, or rather, several snafus that boggled the usual recording of the episode and forced us to re-record. Because of this, we're all a little off our game as we had already settled into each of our separate evening routines, and Mike was unable to join us. So, for better or worse, I got to step up to the plate. Also, because of the odd recording schedule, we lost Tia towards the end of the episode to some urgent business. We're glad everything turned out all right. All of us here on the podcast strive to deliver the best program we can, in both conversation and audio quality. In light of this, I want to take this moment to apologize for any dips in quality in this episode, in either audio or conversation. Mike is a much better host and moderator than I am, and I'm much more at home in the editing chair. I want to thank both Nick and Tia again for giving more of their time to recording. You really saved the show. And now, this week's episode. This is the I Read Comic Books podcast. I am Xander Riggs, standing in for Mike Rappin this week. And this week I am joined by two of our Destroy the Cyborg people, Nick White.
Hey.
And Tia Vasilio.
Hello.
We had some technical difficulties with a previous recording, which is why I am the arbiter for this episode, the stand-in.
Isn't that a character from Halo?
No, it's not. It's not. Let's not even get into video games, because this is comic books, right?
I know. That's why I was trying to keep it on course.
Thank you. Thank you. And you're going to be doing that throughout the entire episode. But to bring it back to our normal podcast, I'll ask you guys, how have comics been?
Comics have been pretty good. The holidays are always a good time to sit down and read some comics and... some old, some new, and generally as a good avoidance policy to not have to put up with family and friends who might want to interact with you.
I heartily endorse that usage of comics.
No, honestly, I did that myself. I had the normal sort of Christmas family gathering, and I took that opportunity to catch up on Miss Marvel from before the series renumbered itself. I had a couple issues left over and figured that was as good a time as any to catch up on that series.
I thought you were going to be like, right before they said grace, I just slammed Sex Crimes on the table and said, "What's up, fam?
I'm out of here. I need some comics."
Well, I bought my mom Bitch Planet for Christmas.
Oh, and how did that go over?
Oh, she loved it.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Does your mom read comics, or?
You know, when she was a little girl, she did, and then she kind of, you know, stopped as she got older, and now she's back into it again because of me and my brother. So it's been a fun thing to share.
That's awesome.
Xander, remember my attempt to get my dad into comics and how that.
I've heard several times. I think my favorite is your story of what happened with the fade out. I don't know if you want to rehash that story Tia. I don't know if Tia has listened to that.
Oh man! So I figured I had finally found a title that was sort of like very grounded. Of course, he's one of those people that if you're gonna try to give him a comic, it honestly can't be Capes and Tights, even though he loves the Nolan Batman movies. Go figure. And so, you know, of course, I found the fade out, which is just, you know, just a gloriously wonderful, beautiful, hard-boiled, you know, mystery in the heyday of Hollywood. And I bought him the trade, the first one, and he read the whole thing. And he's like, "Story isn't finished." I said, "Yeah, that's not all of it." "Well, where's the next one?" It's not out yet. And then I tried to like explain that like
how comics work.
Like, yeah, I was like, you know, if you want, you can get the single issues, which I read, or I can lend you mine. And about 7 seconds into that, his eyes just like glazed over, and I was like, or you can wait until the next book comes out. He's like, what do you mean it's not out already? I was like, is this like some weird like exception? Like, you know, with the John Grisham thing or whatever, like you wait for the next book, and or Harry Potter, you have to wait for the next book. Like, why are comic books not like exempt to that? Yeah. So
I think you need to, basically, I think what you need to do now is just go back farther into comics history.
Yeah.
To pull out stuff that, the stories that have already been completed, so he can just okay, where's the next one? You can hand it to him.
Absolutely. I think maybe I'll buy him Bitch Planet. Jeez.
I'm do gonna, it.
Yeah.
Do it. And then get him to put the tattoo on his face. Oh, wait, that only I think is in the single issue, so it wouldn't be in the trade.
I think he would be quite non-compliant to that idea.
Exactly.
Oh.
So,
well done.
That's the beauty of it.
Right. Oh, man.
Well, I read Ms. Marvel, and I read the last, most recent issue of Omega Men. What did you guys read this last week?
Let me see. I managed to finally get around. I've been slowly putting itty-bitty dents in Future's End, Volume 1. I don't know if you remember, but way back when, DC decided that the best way to make the most quality titles is to have titles that release weekly, because those will guarantee a large amount of success, and definitely not have quality control issues. That being said, I bought Batman Eternal every week, but the one I didn't buy. And,
yes, you do. So you were part of the problem, is what you're saying.
Absolutely. You know, it was kind of a mess, but I was also part of the problem. And to go back to my Ray Fox story from earlier, Ray Fox was arguably the weakest of the writers in that group, in my opinion. But Future's End was the title that ran at the same time, which took place like 5 years in the future, and basically said in 35 years in the future, there's going to be this huge, crazy fallout, and like everyone's going to like die, and there's going to be this big apocalypse shit. And so I skipped that one, because who the hell can afford two weeklies at once? So I bought the first volume. It's like $40. It's like 19 issues, and I've just been putting itty bitty little dents in that. And I definitely had more time for that right now. The weirdest thing is, in every issue, like, obviously it has, this was the inker, this was the colorist, this was the penciler, but under writer, it lists all four of the writers for the series in every issue.
Really?
And it doesn't, like, rotate the order either, so you don't know, like, when you finish an issue, you're like, oh, this one was good, who wrote it? Or, oh, this one was shit, who wrote it?
I mean, do you think it could have been a collaborative effort between all four of them?
Look, if you want to do that, look, I ain't no fool, okay? Take all their names and put them under story, and then put the guy who wrote it under script, okay? It's not that hard. I know how this game is played. Just do that.
There's one guy sitting over his computer, and the other three are leaning over the, you know, the shoulder and saying, oh, now write this.
Did you learn nothing from Mad Max Fury Road? Teamwork is where it's at.
It's all about that.
Like, it's probably like one guy wrote like 98%, and then like Brian Azzarello leaned in and wrote, hey, put in a fart joke, and he's like, you just got credited as a writer. And that's kind of
how it works.
Yeah,
I think
exactly.
That's how you break into the industry.
Yeah.
I mean, so I read that. I read Ninja Act 10, even though I didn't get my glow in the dark cover. It's a tragedy.
Oh,
stuff
no.
happened, so they're gonna send me one with a hard cover instead, which is too bad.
That's just like a regular non-glowing cover.
Yeah, well, it's gonna be the nice like cardstock, which like what you heard there was me slowly trying to justify it to myself and failing.
But the cardstock is nice, to be honest. whenever I get the really like, okay, you want to talk about paper quality, Nick? let's get into this
topic.
Honestly,
you're gonna get like a local access TV show, and it's gonna be like you with paper. It's gonna be like
it's
paper.
Just me and paper. Honestly, that is if I'm going to buy physical comics, paper feel
paper.
Is 50% of it.
It's
50%
true.
Of that. But I won't get into that, because I've gotten into that before, and it's an awful
Wolf
awful
number
pit.
One. Wolf number one had really nice paper.
Okay.
Yeah, get it.
I'm just going to start picking
Sanders
out comics,
like,
not based
pauses.
On writer.
I'm going to have to look that up.
I'm writing that down. I'm not going to, you know, not picking comics based on writer or artist.
Yeah,
paper
yeah,
feel.
Yeah, what's your, how do you pick a new book? Xander's like, well, I go around and I check
touch
the cardstock until they ask me to leave. And,
Well, it's like, okay, you want to talk about really good paper stock,
sure.
Titan Comics.
Yes! Comics. What is it about theirs? It's like really starchy.
They put so much money into their physical printings. It's amazing. But that's that's neither here nor there.
It's sad that you know that, and it's sad that I agree
with you.
This
should be a topic for an episode one day.
Yeah, it should be.
We were going to make it a topic at one point, and I sort of dropped the ball, because I was going to do a lot more research as far as...
Sure.
Comics that are purchased versus quality of said comic, but you know we'll talk about that later on. Yeah. Down the road, I guess.
I guess the only other thing to quick bring up that I thought was kind of not bad, Robin War is actually really good.
Oh,
believe it
God.
Or not, I'm not making it up.
Sorry, yeah.
Tom King is a great writer. He's up and coming. I guarantee he will be on a bunch of people's lists for best new writer of 2015. He's the guy writing Grayson. He's the guy who I think I told you used to work for like the CIA and like in like their counterterrorism unit. So this guy knows his stuff.
That is pretty cool.
Yeah,
I mean, like his work on Grayson. So maybe I'll check out Robin War. I think
he's also the one writing Omega Men, Xander.
I know. Right, I'm just, it's a real hard sell with a comic titled Robin War, you know?
Right.
I don't know.
Ultimately, I would give you this advice because I showed up a little bit late to the game. I was skeptical, picked up an issue or two really late. Then I was like, I need to find the rest of this. But this book bounces. It's like Robin War, and then it goes Grayson, and then it goes Detective Comics, and then it goes We Are Robin, and then it goes Gotham Academy, and then you can see
it's
the problem.
It's all tied in.
So
it's Invisible War.
There's going to be an event trade, and I'm trade waiting for that thing.
Oh man.
So but that's me. What about you, Tia? What have you read?
Well, it's kind of been a very Gillen few weeks for me cuz all of my stuff comes out on the same day and like most of it
Gillen
is
like a villain.
Kieran Gillen. Yep, exactly. That's a good pun. That's a Gillen worthy pun right there. Man. Yeah, that's bad.
Did you know Kieran Gillen and Mike have had mild beef? For a little bit.
Did they?
The beef was only known to Mike, to be fair.
He did. This is not made up.
So we had... He'll tell the story better, but we actually did contact Kieran Gillen via Twitter recently, and he was like, I don't even remember what we were talking about. He's like, if I don't remember it now, it probably wasn't that big of a deal.
Wow. Well,
so what Gillen books are we talking here, Tia?
Really important ones. Okay, it's Wictive 17, which is the finale of the third arc, and the Sakmet Spotlight issue, which I thought was a really important issue because she's kind of been a sort of weird character. You know, she showed up at the beginning kind of chasing the laser dot, and I was worried she was going to be kind of a joke character in a way, you know? But this issue, I thought, presented her as actually a really important kind of counterbalance to Dionysus. I don't know if you guys remember his really amazing issue. I think it was number 8, where Laura goes to the party in his head. It was really beautiful.
I'm reading it in trade, and I've only picked up trade 1, so...
I'm in the same boat, and I will go one step further. I haven't read it yet.
In any case, he talks a lot about how, you know, the ability to facilitate someone being happy for just one night, like, that's not a small thing. And so that the idea of these sort of fleeting pleasures. And then Sakmet, she also talks a lot about, like, just the pursuit of pleasure, and she doesn't care about anything. She just wants, you know, to feel good, but it's clearly very self-destructive. You know, she's an alcoholic, and it's a very dark issue. It gets into her background, which hints at a sort of abusive family and homelessness and all sorts of really, really deep things. So yeah, ending on a high note with Wictive there, we're on hiatus till like April. And a really interesting cliffhanger that I will not spoil, but read it.
I'm on my way.
Yes. And then also Phonogram number 5, which is the penultimate issue of The Immaterial Girl, which has basically been like this weird biography, and I'm pretty sure that Team Phonogram has like cameras in my house or something, because I don't know how it could be that on the nose. Like, if Wictive bludgeons you to death with like a bat. I think that Phonogram is like a sniper rifle to the head. It's just, it's a little bit too precisely painful.
Oh, no.
But in the best possible
I'm
way.
I'm picking that up
it.
Now, too.
I love Whoa. It. It's so good.
No, I really liked the cover art for that.
Yeah, the cover art's great. And the interior art's great. It's all great. And I am Claire, Emily's evil half. And I don't know what to make of that, but there it is. But no, I mean, at the end of the day, I think it's a really interesting study in relationships and also just sort of figuring out how to like yourself, which is not an easy thing. And and so, you know,
I need this book.
You do.
Yeah, it's real deep and personal.
But also has a lot of great music references. And, oh, and these glossaries just crack me up because, you know, I like the same music as what is going into the making of these books, so I catch most of the references. Yeah. But it's just funny to me to then read the glossary and see how it's presented to people who don't necessarily listen to that music. It's pretty funny.
Yeah.
Well, I definitely have to ask Tia, like, based on the books you just told me, all of that sounds like very weighty and meditative, and like I have to wonder, like, what does that mean, Xander? Look, let me finish. You'll laugh when I'm done. Okay,
I will. I promise.
Like, is there like sort of like a nightcap book that you just throw on the end where you're like, haha, and then after that, Donald Duck, because life is okay? Or is that like you just like turn off the light and you're like, I'm one with the darkness?
I mean, pretty much that one. I would say, yeah.
See, I have Bob's Burgers, and that just goes at the end when shit gets too serious. That's the last book I read, and then I'm like, everything is fine.
No.
Wow.
What do I read that's fun? No, I'm pretty solidly in the, like, hurt so good camp of comics reading.
Just read the real deep stuff, and then ponder the imponderables.
See, I have a pile of campy stuff, and I have a pile of light stuff, so when shit gets too serious, I just throw Alien Vampirella at the end.
That is a pretty good one, though. I will not argue with that.
Oh my god, Xander. I love crazy mashups. Anytime. Like, I know. Comic books take themselves too serious these days, and that's like a minor soapbox thing in its own right, but when you just randomly slam characters together, because publishers are way too protective of their characters these days.
I heard you talk about Archie and Predator.
Yeah!
And, yes!
And now I've got to find that.
God damn, that book is so good!
Going on from what we read last week, what are you guys looking forward to this week?
For me, it's definitely going to be Dr. Fate, number 7. I don't have a big pull. I don't have a big pull this week. I don't have a big pull next week. But it's between that and Black Magic. And I always try to, you know, fight for the little guy a little bit. Black Magic does not need my help right now. That book is riding a wave, and it does not need my assistance. It's Greg Rucka. He needs no help. From me. But Dr. Fate, wow, some of the most gorgeous art I have ever seen. Definitely way better than DC is used to. It's Sonny Liu, who did the artwork for The Shadow Hero, which I think you're probably familiar with, Xander. I think you've read that.
Yeah.
So just gorgeous, gorgeous art. And it's the story of this probably like mid-20s Egyptian-American Muslim medical student. He's in the middle of medical school, and he's like trying to get ready for all of his tests and everything like that. And all of a sudden, I don't remember which sort of Egyptian god is like chaos and whatnot, but they decide, you know, the earth is unclean and they're gonna wipe it out with a giant flood. And then one of the other Egyptian gods, I'm so good at mythology, shows up and he's like, yo, this helmet, it does cool stuff, and you're worthy, maybe, we'll see. Gives him the helmet. Now he has powers. I'm like two books behind, but again, like the biggest point is like, I don't think Paul Levitz is the best writer for this. He's sort of like DC old guard. He's better known for like Legion of Superheroes. I mean, it's still very much like trying to do like Miss Marvel in terms of like an emphasis on family and culture and belonging and feeling in some ways like you don't belong because you're like a generation removed from, you know, your family that immigrated. It doesn't quite hit those emotional beats as well as I think Miss Marvel does, from what little I know of Miss Marvel. But again, artwork just absolutely fucking stunning. It does not look like anything else DC has these days. I hope to God that if this book ends up getting canceled, which I hope it doesn't, that DC finds a way to lock this guy down, because this artwork is just phenomenal.
Yeah. What about you, Tia? What are you looking forward to this week?
Well, continuing the Kieran Gillen trend, Mercury Heat number 6 is coming out, and it's the final issue.
The Gillagy, because there's three of them.
You're just on point with these.
Well, you are on fire.
I am so sorry, Tia. I should not be interrupting you, but they keep showing up. And
you can't be a Kieran Gillen fan and not appreciate puns.
I think that's a rule.
Right? It's a rule.
Okay.
It's somewhere in there you sign something.
Yeah, you do. Sure. So yeah, Mercury Heat, I typically do not feel that Avatar books are for me for a number of reasons.
Yeah.
And I sometimes
you fucking love Crossed Xander.
Yeah. Can't do it.
I don't at all.
And there is a good amount of like blood spray, guts, eyeballs popping, brains showing, all that sort of gruesome stuff. Like, it's really pretty great. Yeah. I can
appreciate the Avatar checklist.
Yeah. Less excited about the gratuitous TNA, especially because it just seems really out of character for Louisa, who's the main character of this book. She is this sort of for hire cop on Mercury, which is kind of the Wild West, and she's investigating a murder, and she's uncovering this larger conspiracy, and she has her trusty sidekick, who's kind of a sexist asshole, and he's constantly getting sort of reprimanded by her and fucking everything up. And spoiler alert, things don't go well for him in issue 5, so I'm really excited to see how things get wrapped up here.
He lasts that long, huh?
Yeah, you know, I can appreciate that kind of character when he's very clearly the stand-in for, like, actual douchebags, and you're not, you know, and you mm-hmm. see in the story, like, oh, yeah, that's kind of a shitty person. Right. You know, his assholishness is not celebrated in any way, and he's sort of... I don't know. I mean, I feel bad because things don't go well for him, but not that bad because he is kind of a douche.
So is this book just like a mini series, or is it an ongoing?
I think it's an ongoing. I'm pretty sure it's an ongoing. It's really neat. I liked it since the Free Comic Book Day debut. The world building is really interesting. Like, you can... There's a lot of neat stuff happening with memory and cognitive skills and things like that. And you sort of, you get evaluated by the powers that be, and you're categorized by personality type, and that limits what you're allowed to do with your life. And so Louisa has been categorized basically as a psychopath, so she's not allowed to be a cop in the civilized world. So that's why she's on Mercury as a sort of cop for hire. And it's really great when people fuck with her and she's just like, you know, I'm a psychopath, right? And then blood spray happens.
All right.
Yeah. I think this book paints Mercury law enforcement in a very... unfair way. This is not, well, at least I know where to not get pulled over, so.
Well, yeah.
Well, my pick for the week is Omega Men number 7, like we mentioned earlier, written by Tom King. This, ever since, Nick, you told me about this series, I think it was a really hard sell at first, because you were like, yeah, Omega Man's great, and I was just kind of like, yeah, whatever, Nick, I'm going to go read whatever comic I'm happening to read at the time.
That's fair, that's an opinion you've learned to develop over years, and that's for sure. It's a survival instinct, really.
It's not okay, because you know what, I should have listened to you about Omega Men sooner.
You're doing it digitally, right? Because I'm an idiot, and I was not pulling it, and now I need to find number 6. So that being said, if any of our listeners have number 6, I need it.
Send it to us.
Please.
In a manila envelope. No. So this, I think this series, even though because I overlooked it, and then I'd read the, 4 or 5 issues that were out.
Yeah.
over the course of, I think, two sittings. It is surprisingly good. I think it's a great look at, I mean, all of the characters in it are people that are trying to find their place in a world where they feel like they need a higher calling, where everyone feels like they have this higher calling, and they're sort of, I guess, fighting the establishment in their own way. But it's not so much a fight the power book as it is a finding your place in the galaxy kind of book, I think. And I think that's what really hooked me, that yeah. it's about people finding themselves and finding their place among their group and trying to do right by the people around them. And the artwork is fantastic. I think the cover artwork specifically was what sold the book to me when you handed me the physical issue and said, "This is Omega Men, you're getting this."
Yeah.
And I saw this cover, it doesn't look like a DC book, except for the little DC icon in the corner that says it's a DC book.
Which I quickly tried to cover up with my thumb, yes.
I think it's like an indie book in the guise of this DC book, or vice versa, however you want to interpret that.
they look like 1930s Art Deco tourism posters, like the ones we used to see, like the train, and it's like Visit Canada or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, and with the Omega Men title painted over it in sort of a graffiti-esque kind of way.
Oh, that's right. They would sabotage him. That's right. Jesus, of course. Yeah, yeah.
And so you want to...
We love Canada. Go ahead.
If you're looking for the sixth issue, the cover of that is like a poster, like one of those tourism or propaganda posters, but it's torn down the middle, and it reveals like another page or another cover, quote unquote, behind it, which sort of sets the feel for the rest of that issue. And the way that these issues are written, I think, also sort of blows my mind, because they can each sort of be contained. I know you've mentioned it before on this podcast, Nick, but each issue is sort of summed up by a quote or saying from somebody, and I just sort of read the quote and I just spaced on who said the one from issue six. But it's written in such a way that it's that each issue can stand alone, but that it works together when, you know, linked together in a trade or throughout the whole series. And I'm pretty sure this is only going for the length of another trade, right?
They went all over the frickin' board on this thing. It was supposed to be 12, then it was supposed to be canceled. Then they said it was going to be 12 again, and now they're saying it will at least be 12, and depending upon how things work, it could go on beyond that. DC is just all over the damn board. It's great.
I guess we'll see. Yeah. Whatever issues they choose to give me, I will take.
I just love that.
That makes it exciting.
Yeah.
Will I get an issue? Who knows?
Will DC put my book on blast? Who knows? But I know they put mine on blast. On fleek. Honestly, like, if there was ever proof for like human surveillance, they must honestly find my pull list and just be like, "All right, here we go."
Nick doesn't need this book.
But then you get to experience the exquisiteness of heartbreak and longing, which is such a romantic place to be if you think about it.
Well, DC does me a favor, because like with Marvel it would be like, all right, is this new, is this all new, is this all new, all different, is this point five issue,
it's
point
all
five
new, all
is this
different
issue
and
1.5
uncanny and amazing.
Yeah. DC's like, we don't do that shit. Your book is dead or alive, and in your case it's dead. I think I just need to really start repping Batman real hard and just turn it into a game of chicken with them, where I'm just like, oh man, that Scott Snyder Batman, it's so good. They're just like, you know, come at me, bro.
Just to test your powers, that would be good.
Oh man, do it.
I just can't wait. I just get a Twitter notification right now. Scott Snyder, that's it, I'm off Batman.
I really just started thinking about this topic when I read a post on Tumblr that Kate Leth wrote, and it seemed like at first she was kind of trying to almost justify why creators push their books so hard for pre-order, because of course, you know, it puts you in kind of a weird position as a reader. You don't necessarily want to promise that you're going to buy a book that you've never read or that might not even be made yet. So, you know, and she talked about how really this was a sort of necessary evil because of the really bizarre way that comics are distributed and sometimes also marketed. And she then talked a little bit about her experience working at a comic shop and how difficult it can be sometimes to order comics if you're a comic shop. Diamond distributors are a monopoly. They're the only ones, and there's all kinds of weird rules, and you know, it's hard to predict what you want to stock and what people are going to want to buy when the book isn't even out yet and you really have nothing to go on except the creative team.
Yeah, and what it sort of made me think of before was the whole issue of, obviously I think all of us follow comic book creators on Twitter. Why not? Gail Simone is absolutely hilarious. Anyone who can keep up posting pictures of R2-D2 and calling it BB-8 for 3 or 4 days nonstop and have everyone get mad. I mean, I'll follow that person to the ends of the earth, period.
Absolutely.
but absolutely. It's really interesting to see what Twitter users are very, very comfortable and end up for plugging their books all of the time. And which ones aren't. Like Jimmy Palmiotti, like every week he'll be like, guess what guys, this week Wednesday, this book comes out. You know, please pay attention, pick it up if you can, you know, support us. And I think people know that that's just the way the game is played. I think maybe someone who was unfamiliar with the scene would be like, wow, like quit spamming my Twitter feed. But he understands more or less that, like, if you talk to anybody from the comic book store owner to the creator to anyone on the team to the publisher, it basically what you hear over and over and over again is pre-order or anything else beyond that point is borderline irrelevant.
Which is really awful because it just reinforces the closed loop that is comics, you know?
Yeah. And Tia, you and I were talking about this briefly before the show started, in terms of how social media seems to be the fallback option for when you can't get your comics marketed through, you know, publications like Diamond.
Definitely.
So I guess, and Nick, you said that that's sort of just how the game is played. And I think it's become that more or less as more and more comic creators enter social media, whether it's Twitter or Tumblr or Facebook or all three or the mystery fourth one, whatever they choose to use.
Google Plus.
Google Plus always.
To get a hold of all the grandmas out there.
Exactly. My local comic book store is nice enough that if you buy one thing out of the catalog, they refund the cost of the catalog. So most months it's more than, you know, I'm gonna recoup the cost. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting to see how different publishers handle their section of the previews catalog, because while previews naturally edits and maintains and organizes the whole thing, they sort of leave a lot of the layout stuff and whatnot in each section to the publisher's whims. And so it's really interesting how if you're a DC book, in previews, you will get the writer and artist listed and a really short summary of what's going on, and you'll get an image, and then a lot of times it might even say not final art, and that's all you're going on. That's all you're going on for publicity, and I don't think that that is unusual for a big two book like we've talked about. Big Right. two are relying on selling characters. At least that's the way it used to be. Recently, they've come maybe a little late to the game to understand that creators are important, and that if they can get some of these creators to, like Jeff Lemire or Cullen Bunn or Tom King or, yeah, I'm sure there are great Marvel examples that I'm struggling to come up with. I don't know who they are. If they can, like, lock them down and say, like, look, guys, we're kind of artsy, too. Sort of. At least we got this guy, right?
Well, it was like 2 years ago when they brought... When they were like, when everybody was just going crazy over Mike Del Mundo's art. So I think the first time I was really conscious of him as an artist was when I saw his cover art for X-Men Legacy. I don't know if you've seen any of the, and this is the most recent, this was Simon Spurrier's run on X-Men Legacy.
This is a guy that looks like Beakman from Beakman's World, right?
Right, with the big Eraserhead hair. And his artwork for that was amazing, and it was just cover artwork, but that was the first time I really noticed him, and then I started looking up his other cover art, and it's all just, for me, mind-blowing. When his artwork started being received by more and more comic readers, people were like, we need to get him on the interior of all of these different books. And Marvel, like, proudly, like, brought him out. They didn't bring him out on the stage, but they've had his name up on this, you know, PowerPoint presentation that they had at Comic-Con and or at C2E2 when I was there 2 years ago, and they were like, yeah, we're putting him on this book, and it was Elektra, and I was dubious at the time, and then the series came out and I was like, my dubiousness was confirmed as the book was not great. But so you have these opportunities for artists and for writers, and they might not do well. It might be because of overarching story with the publisher, if it's big two or what have you, but I don't know, I guess.
Recently Valiant had a similar scenario where they took a guy, Raul Allen. You've probably mm-hmm. seen me post 80 quadrillion of his covers online. And he was just strictly doing covers for them. He was doing their Kick-Ass Imperium covers. He was doing their Imperium covers for a really long time. He did all of the Ivar Time Walker covers, if you've ever seen any of those. They are just gorgeous as hell. And it's really fascinating to see a guy come from a graphic design perspective and really have an eye for really unique shots and angles and different ways of framing things that aren't like conventional comic book art. And then they announced that they were going to put him on interiors, and I was like, okay, let's see how this goes.
Yeah.
And like 9 times out of 10, you're like, is this guy going to be able to meet like a monthly schedule? Because like, is this like J.H. Williams III, like all over again? And
yeah.
The guy's like, give me 5 months and I'll show you what I got at that point. But it almost seems like Valiant did a test run with him, because they're like, all right, you're going to do Bloodshot Reborn 5. And then you're going to do Ninjak, like, 6. And then it almost seems like they were kind of testing him. And then they said, if that goes well, we'll let you have whatever. And now he's doing the interiors for Wrath of Eternal Warrior. So, and absolutely killing it. But, yeah, it's interesting to see them sort of make that shift with artists. And they're like, well, you really liked this guy. How about we put him on interiors? And you're right, that doesn't always work. Sometimes they can't meet the deadlines, and sometimes... I don't know what it is. Sometimes they don't have an eye for like the more like necessary establishing shots that interiors require that mm-hmm. maybe aren't as exciting, and they aren't like the sort of poses and panels you would put on the cover of a book and be like, this is what draws you to buy it. But the artist has to be able to do those in order to actually render a story. You know what I mean? Actually, and you know, feel free to do with this whatever you want. I think what's really interesting is that, like I said, with DC and with like Marvel, like when it's the previous catalog, they're like, look, here's an image. It might be final art. It might not be. Here's who's writing it. That's pretty much it. And that's all we feel you need to know. And sure, again, big two, they're in the business of selling characters for the most part.
Yeah.
But when you move outside of the big two, when you move to Dark Horse to some extent, especially when you move to Image, all of a sudden you're getting one or two, even three or four pages Although that sometimes, that's like if Image has a huge book they're yeah. trying to promote, and all of a sudden you're getting multiple pages of the book. And yeah, that's sort of reserved for, I think one of the last times Image did it was when Grant Morrison's Nameless rolled around, and they're like, we got Grant Morrison. But they're like, we can't title yeah. the book We Got Grant Morrison, as much as we really
as
would like
as they
to
would
title
love
the
that
book.
Title.
Yeah, We Got Grant Morrison, five exclamation points. So they're like, we're going to call it Nameless. That way we don't write Grant Morrison.
They should just call it Untitled.
Call it, wish we could have called it We Got Grant Morrison.
We're so excited to tell you about the series because we got Grant Morrison, but we don't know what the book is.
Exactly. So like that's how they handle it, which is really interesting that with Image, virtually every single time they have a book, they have to find a way of actually getting the word out.
Right.
And like being like, this is a brand new story with characters you've probably never seen before that have never been in the series up to this point.
And but to a certain extent, I think that a lot of the, especially with Image, you have a lot of books with writers and artists that you've seen before.
Right, no, and that's not the modern state of Image, and that's what's fascinating now, is that right. a lot of these people over at Image, as I was saying before, like, if they can get one-third, one-eighth, whatever, of their DC following, or their, like I said, their quote-unquote steady job, and be like, you know what, if you like, I don't know, if you like Hawkeye, then come over here and read Sex Criminals, or if you like...
That's a weird pitch, but okay.
Which is weird, but whatever. Or, I don't even remember, Jason Aaron is Thor, I think. Hey, if you like Thor, here's Southern Bastards, which also involves clubbing people with blunt objects, so don't say I can't bring this around, because I can, just did.
You did it,
son, I'm proud of you, said my dad. He'll do it, he'll say it sometime. I'm waiting.
I think that's true, though, because especially when you follow them on social media, or if they're a big enough writer that... You know, in the comic shop, people are saying, oh, have you heard of the new title by so-and-so? I feel like it travels by word of mouth. It travels by through social media. It even goes through the monthly previews books. You'll see that stuff. And I think it's pushed pretty heavily, posted by both the creators and fans. I think that's not out of place to see that there.
Yeah, and I think it's unfair, but I almost feel like there's some weird stigma or idea that it's like, well, if you like my DC work where I'm phoning it in, wink, wink, then you ought to follow me over to my passion project. This is where I do my art, you know? And that's like a minor soapbox for me, because let me tell you, Jeff Lemire's Green Arrow run is right up there with so much of his quality independent work.
For sure.
And I think it's all kind of unfair in a lot of ways that Image is quote unquote where people do what they really want to do, but that's sort of the stigma that we're at today.
It's definitely how people see it.
Right. It's like, come over here where I put on my big boy pants, and it's not fair, I think, in a lot of ways. But it's almost weird in a way, because, and maybe this is like a minor soapbox, and I apologize if it is, and maybe this is me just being counterculture, but like the main idea these days is you follow creators, you don't follow characters. But I almost feel like that's a very insular idea, and it's certainly, yeah. I can understand why the big two are scared of it, because that's terrifying, that the moment the creator leaves...
The creators hold more power than right. the intellectual property that the publisher owns.
Exactly. But... And this is the sort of experience that requires time and money and patience to afford. But it's really, really fascinating sometimes to actually be able to sit on a book and watch two or three teams move through that book and see how they're different and see how you know, do things successfully or unsuccessfully.
See how characters change over time, even.
Absolutely. And see if it becomes more plot-driven or more character-driven. Yeah. That's something you don't really get if you follow creators. And I think in a weird way, following creators in some ways almost seems more insular than not, depending exactly. upon what sort of exposure you have outside of that.
My own experience with that, I think I wouldn't have ever heard about Kari Kyle Andrews unless I had picked up that Iron Fist issue or that series, because I ended up picking up the whole series because I not only did I I pick up the first issue because I liked Iron Fist, but I picked up the rest of it because I love how Kari Kyle Andrews handled that character and handled that story. I think he knew that it was going to be a limited run. It wasn't going to be an ongoing series forever, and so he ended it, and he constructed his entire run of that in such a way that it felt very... I mean, I don't want to compare comic books to movies, but Kari Kyle Andrews, his background is in filmmaking, and so it felt very cinematic. It wasn't very comic booky, I guess, is what I'm getting at. It felt incredibly like a movie, but it was... I wouldn't have heard about that if I hadn't have just picked up something because I enjoyed a character.
I hear you on that one. I read a bit of Green Arrow before Lemire came on, and I sort of had an idea of what sort of a mess it was. And then Lemire showed up, and it was hilarious because sometimes you just... It's worth sticking out a book to see how a writer, how a team is able to basically find a way to throw all of the other stuff away, and how efficiently they're able to do it. And it was just fascinating to watch him basically be like, guess what? Everyone he loves, dead, no money, on the run. He's like, guess what? I'm going to do it all.
And but it worked out so well.
Yeah, it was amazing how well he fluidly basically threw everything to the wind and turned and shaped the book into what he wanted. And I think that's what I find really interesting as well, is how quickly and how easily and how well creators are able to basically reclaim whatever they, you know, whatever they're looking for. And what's weird is I stuck it out on that book after Lemire left. And I stuck it out for when the writers of Arrow came on the book. And I know I've talked about this before.
You've mentioned it to me.
But, oh man, like, it was fascinating to watch them attempt to inject lots of elements of the show that were not prevalent or even present in the comic at all at that point. But I stuck it out completely.
And you kind of wonder, like, how much of that was them and how much of that was DC trying to tie all of their media together. Yeah. Because at the time, I feel like they were... I mean, because, yeah, there was the Arrow comic book that was more along the lines of the show.
Yeah, and that's what was so weird. Like, I was like, is my book going to be hands-off at this point, or is...
Are they going to meld the two books together?
basically. And they're like, remember how Felicity wasn't in Green Arrow at all, but now she is? And remember how... I think Diggle was...
Did they do that? Did they insert her into Green Arrow? I didn't stick around.
Yes. Yes, they did.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, they did. And Diggle was worked in during the Lemire run, but of course they made him far more prevalent. You get the idea. But to really show the payoff here, I stuck it out through that, which was maybe not the brightest idea, but I've been following with great attention the new team that's on it, which is Ben Percy writing, who did a fantastic two little... mini series for Detective Comics called Terminal, which was about an airport, obviously. And they put him on it, and then they put Patrick Zercher on art, who has just been generally solid all over the board. And I said, all right, I'll stick it out for that. And that book right now is crazy and fun. And he's like going down to Mexico to like fight the cartels because they stole his dog.
Oh, no.
And, like, it has to do with his dog is from this... harkens from this genealogical ancestry crap where these guys are following them because they believe bones have power. And this dog comes from this ancestry where they want... It's crazy. It's crazy, Xander.
I have, like a whole separate soapbox about dogs. Maybe it's because I didn't have a dog as a kid, but I do not empathize with dogs. If you show me a book or a comic book or a movie about a dog, that is like I will actively avoid that. I do not empathize with dogs. I empathize with people. People. Come on.
Right. No dog is going to bring you Taco Bell home on their way back from work. It's not going to happen. That's really, like, forget all that Turing test about, like, when does a computer become a person? Let me tell you what.
When does a dog become a person?
A person becomes a valued human being when they are capable
Taco Bell.
of putting quesadillas in front of you. And up until that point, I mean, what are they? Just a shell of a man. That's just...
Yeah, God.
So
Taco Bell, if you would like to sponsor our podcast, please contact us.
Please do. I mean, Baja Blast is pretty fucking expensive if you weren't at Taco Bell, so... and Sangria Blast. I love that too, guys. Oh, so... God.
Thanks for listening to the I Read Comic Books podcast, a production of Destroy the Cyborg. The show's producer is Mike Rappin, and our editor is Xander Riggs. This week's music was brought to you by Metaform, Narosh, Brock Berrigan, and Infinity Shred. If you're listening to this podcast on iTunes or Stitcher, we would love it if you would take a quick moment to rate us. Your comments and ratings help others find the show, and let us know how we're doing. Otherwise, if you just want to say hi, you can email the show at cyborg@destroythecyb.org. Each email we get means a lot to us, and lets us interact with all of you out there. Maybe you started reading a book we suggested. Maybe you have a suggestion for us. If email's not your game, feel free to shoot us a message on Twitter, @destroythecyb, or through the hashtag IReadComicBooks. You can also follow us on Tumblr, @destroythecyborg, and check out our subreddit at ireadcomicbooks.reddit.com. And as always, thank you for listening.
Can I quick ask your Iron Fist? Can I ask you the Iron Fist Catch 22 question? What do you want to see happen with that? With the depiction?
What do you mean?
Because it sounds like Catch 22 both ways. You're screwed.
Like, screwed. Like, you mean like in terms of who would be portraying him in the
right,
series?
Right. So if you get a Caucasian, you make the comic book accuracy people happy.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And they're like, well, it's like the comic book, so good. Now you've appealed to 1% of the people watching the show, maybe at most 5, at absolute most probably 5. And that's great, except now you've created the white person, you know, and again, I don't follow Marvel that much, so correct me if any of this is wrong. This is just what I've heard. Uh-huh. So you have the white person goes to, like, the Orient or the East or whatever,
to the mystical, magical Kung Fu city.
Yeah, absolutely. And becomes better than them at what they are supposed to be good at, which, you know, that's the white savior stereotype top of the Asian people are great at Kung Fu stereotype. So
this is... Let me get up on my soapbox here for a little bit. No, it's not even a soapbox, because I think this is what
Let me quick
I would
give
like.
The alternative there, which, of course, is you get an Asian Iron Fist, which, correct me if I'm wrong, now means you're not following the comic book, but now you're proudly reinforcing the idea that Asian people are fantastic at Kung Fu.
Right, right. So this is, I think this is splitting the difference. And I guess to anyone listening, I am biracial. So I have, I don't want to say that I'm like the only person that could answer this question, but from my perspective, I think this would be a good middle ground. So I really liked Matt Fraction and David Aja's Immortal Iron Fist. And I think the reason that I liked that was that it showed that Danny Rand as the Iron Fist was part of a legacy. He wasn't the Iron Fist. He was part of a line of people that were Iron Fist. And so it wasn't him as a person, it was a title that he inherited.
It's
so
like Batman.
Right. And so I think if we were to show Danny Rand as his canonical Caucasian character, alliteration.
I think you're always right, so I'm glad you understand how alliteration works.
But I think to show him as the character from the comic book would appease those that want it to be canonical or true to the comics. But I think that to show his character, and depending on how you, I mean, obviously all of this depends on how they want to weave this into Daredevil and Jessica Jones and Luke Cage. But if you want to show him in his solo series, I think it would be amazing to show him in line as the successor to the Iron Fist, that he is one of many, and that all of the ones that came before him were pretty much all Asian, and that it was this fluke that made him, that he happened to be in this mystical city, that he happened to be there. That is what made him, like, luck in some sense of the word, or you could say destiny or whatever. That is what made him Iron Fist. It, you know, it's not this, you know, whole, you know, the white savior stereotype that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's one way to approach it. I think for me, I would rather Danny Rand be his, like, comic book Caucasian character. But I definitely understand people being upset with, I guess, casting choices for the character. On the other hand, if they're upset with a Caucasian person being cast as Danny Rand, they should be equally upset with the comic book's character. So I guess you could look at it that way. I don't know. If you're going to be angry with one, you got to be angry
with
the
other. Carry your anger further back. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, just hold on to your anger and carry that with you. No.
Well, I know it's a mess because I heard for a while they were considering scrapping Iron Fist as part of the set just because they didn't know how to
he's
do
part
this.
Of the Heroes for Hire, I think.
Right. Oh yeah, and I mean there's enough setup in Daredevil to clearly pave the way for it. I mean, that's the thing with Stick and Stone.
We'll see how they handle it, but I think if they wanted to take it in the direction even of Netflix's series Marco Polo and show that yes, there is a Caucasian person in this world, but that there are a lot of, I mean, because the idea is that we want, especially the people that are hoping that Danny Rand be cast with an Asian actor, I think the hope is that that series will give Asian actors work, and I mm-hmm. think that could be accomplished by making, you know, his supporting cast of characters Asian actors. At the same time, I understand the alternative that you proposed to me. I don't think there. I mean, when you look at any media, there's no way that you're going to make everyone happy, and there will always [S2] Right. [S1] Be people that will naysay and critique, and I think that's fine. I think the fact that is bringing that to the forefront of discussion surrounding that show, I think that's great, and I think that stuff needs to be talked about.
I think sometimes it just boils down to whether or not you're willing to make baby steps in the right direction or make none because you're not getting everything you wanted out of something.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
And I mean, maybe I'll, you know, like almost minorly spoil Marco Polo, but that the main character being Caucasian, he's not even like the best character. Like, he doesn't save the day. In fact, there's a lot of times when he tries to be that, you know, the Caucasian white savior, and then he just fucks it all up.
And really, all he ends up being is sort of the POV character.
Right. He's not
phenomenal. He's not the smartest person. He's not the most powerful person.
He's the vessel through which the viewer is introduced to the world.
They're like, you're probably white, person who's watching this. This guy is white too.
I mean, just look at like statistics, and I think the majority of people who watch Netflix are...
You're sitting down watching
white.
Netflix. You are likely Caucasian. Oh boy, Xander, please cut all of this if you're listening. All of this discussion. We can
leaving it all in.
Slice that little soapbox out.